Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. In a few moments, I'll be shining the spotlight on the figure of Edmund Campion. Being terribly English by speaking of George Eliot. And joining our popular Latin lover in the city of Londinium. Well, thanks so much for joining me once again. Less than a month before Pope Benedict XVI's forthcoming apostolic visit to England, we shine the spotlight on a household name in Catholic circles across this nation. He's Edmund Campion, whom Pope Paul VI proclaimed saint in October of 1970, among the 40 martyrs of England and Wales. So stay tuned, as in a few moments Jill Bevilacqua will focus on the figure of this English Jesuit, born in London in 1540, and hanged, drawn and quartered at Tyburn. One who was a scholar and a gentleman, typifying the dedicated Catholic priest of penal times, always in danger, knowing that sooner or later, betrayal and martyrdom were inevitable.
On the day of the execution, December the 1st, 1581, it was raining. It had been raining for some days, and the roads of the city were foul with mud. A great crowd had collected at the gates. There were two horses, each with a hurdle at his tail. Campion was bound to one of them. Then he was slowly dragged through the mud and rain, up Cheapside, past St. Martin le Grand and Newgate, along Holborn to Tyburn. The scene at Tyburn was tumultuous. Sir Thomas More had stepped out into the summer sunshine to meet death quietly and politely at a single stroke of the axe. Every circumstance of Campion's execution was vile and gross. Bedraggled and mud-stained, he mounted the cart which stood below the gallows. The noose was put over his neck. The noise of the crowd was continuous, and only those in his immediate neighbourhood could hear him as he began to speak. In a few halting sentences, he made himself heard above the clamour. He forgave the jury and asked forgiveness of any whose names he might have compromised during his examination. He then stood in silent prayer, head bowed and his hands folded on his breast. The cart was then driven from under him. The eager crowd swayed forward, and Campion was left hanging until, unconscious, perhaps already dead, he was cut down, and the butcher began his work. On the 25th of October 1970, after a protracted historical investigation, Pope Paul VI proclaimed as saints 40 English and Welsh Catholics, known traditionally as the 40 Martyrs. One of these, Edmund Campion, is a household name. Evelyn Waugh wrote in his biography,
"He was one of a host of martyrs, each in their several ways gallant and venerable. Some performed more sensational feats of adventure, some sacrificed more conspicuous positions in the world. Many suffered crueler tortures. But to his own, and to each succeeding generation, Campion's fame has burned with unique warmth and brilliance. It was his genius to express, in sentences that have resounded across the centuries, the spirit of chivalry in which they suffered, to typify in his zeal, his innocence, his inflexible purpose, the pattern which they followed."
Thank you.
In 1568, Cardinal William Allen had established in Douai, Flanders, an English college for the purpose of training Catholic missionaries for the dangerous work of re-Catholicising England and giving hope and renewed strength to those true believers who still clung to their faith. Priests were needed in England because most of the bishops were either in prison or under detention, and it was almost impossible for them to ordain new priests.
Within a few years, Douai was sending some 20 priests a year to England, of whom, before the end of Elizabeth's reign, 160 had died on the scaffold. At Douai, the teaching concentrated chiefly on controversial texts, and in their spiritual exercises, the young men were prepared for sacrifice. They were being trained as missionaries and as martyrs.
It was to this extraordinary seminary that Edmund Campion came in the June of 1571. Campion had distinguished himself early as a scholar, and at 17 was a Fellow of St. John's, Oxford. When Queen Elizabeth made her state visit to the college, Campion's address was the success of the afternoon. But fellows were expected to take holy orders, and Campion, although brought up as an Anglican, was becoming increasingly uneasy about his religious position.
He proceeded no further than ordination as deacon, and when pressure was put on him to declare himself, he obtained permission to travel abroad and went to Ireland. Before the year was out, he was warned of possible arrest, and realizing he was exposing friends to danger, he left in disguise for the continent.
Douai, Campion was immersed for the first time in a holy Catholic environment. Martyrdom was spoken of freely, and the young men prayed for it in secret, as the supreme privilege of which only divine grace could make them worthy. In this rarefied atmosphere, Campion saw his previous Anglican acquiescence as a gross betrayal, and felt himself unable to continue living there as the distinguished immigrant he was considered to be. He took his theology degree and left for Rome to enter the Society of Jesus, believing that only in the discipline and vigilance of the Ignatian rule could he hope to become worthy of a martyr's crown.
He was assigned to the Jesuits' Austrian province, and in 1578 he was ordained priest. After a few years as professor of rhetoric in Prague, he received a summons from Cardinal Allen. He had been chosen to join the next mission to England. "Our harvest is already great," wrote Allen. "Ordinary labourers are not enough. More practised men are wanted, but chiefly you and others of your order."
Campion's destiny was now clear. Over his bed, someone painted a garland of roses and lilies, the emblem of martyrdom. And the night before his departure, a Salesian ecstatic inscribed above his cell the words, "P. Edmundus Campianus, Martyr." At this point, the gentle scholar enters the world of violence.
The object of the Jesuits' mission was clearly stated and limited: the preservation and augmentation of the faith of the Catholics in England. They were forbidden absolutely to involve themselves in questions of state or to send back political reports. When the party stopped at Reims, Campion bade farewell to Cardinal Allen.
"As for me, all is over. I have made a free oblation of myself to His Divine Majesty, both for life and death, and I hope He will give me grace and force to perform. This is all I desire."
Once in England, the Jesuits were advised by a Catholic gentleman, Thomas Pound, to draw up a written statement of their aims, to avoid forged confessions of treason being circulated later by the government. Campion's brag, as it was called, became his manifesto. He proclaimed that he was a priest and a Jesuit, sent under obedience to England, to preach the gospel, administer the sacraments, and instruct the simple. He stated that the Catholic case was unanswerable, and claimed that the faith was absolutely satisfactory to the mind, enlisting all knowledge and reason in its cause, and that it was completely compelling to anyone who gave it an indifferent and quiet audience. The last part of the brag is a clarion call.
Many innocent hands are lifted up to heaven for you daily by those English students whose posterity shall never die, which beyond seas, gathering virtue and sufficient knowledge for the purpose, are determined never to give you over, but either to win you heaven or to die upon your pikes. And touching our society, be it known to you that we have made a league, all the Jesuits in the world, whose succession and multitude must overreach all the practices of England, cheerfully to carry the cross you shall lay upon us, and never to despair your recovery while we have a man left to enjoy your Tyburn, or to be racked with your torments, or consumed with your prisons. The expense is reckoned, the enterprise is begun. It is of God. It cannot be withstood. So the faith was planted, so it must be restored.
Campion's mission lasted a year. Up and down England he went, finding everywhere constancy and devotion, despite the fact that many of his hosts were in mourning for one or other of their number. No other talk but of death, flight, prison, or spoil of friends, he wrote. But the loyalty and discretion he met moved him to write in his report.
There will never want in England men that will have care of their salvation, nor such as shall advance other men's. Neither shall this church here ever fail, so long as priests and pastors shall be found for their sheep. Rage, man, or the devil, never so much.
On Campion's arrival at a house, Catholics of every degree would gather. He sat up half the night receiving them, hearing confessions, resolving difficulties. Before dawn, a room would be prepared for Mass and watches set. Mass said and communion given, Campion would preach. And it was his popularity as a preacher that proved his undoing. Danger was ever present, and as a rule, he never stayed long in one place.
But on the fatal occasion he returned to a house to give a sermon to those who had missed him, his presence was discovered, and a few days later, he was in the Tower. After 4 days in the Little Ease, a kind of cage in which it was impossible for a grown man to stand erect or to lie at full length, he was summoned before Elizabeth and given a chance to recant. She and her politicians couldn't understand the mentality of a man like Campion. To die deliberately, without hope of release, for an idea, this was something beyond their comprehension. Faith, as something concrete and indestructible, of such transcendent value that once it was held, all other possessions became a mere encumbrance, this was unknown to them. Campion did not satisfy them, and 5 days later, he was put to the torture.
In the next 4 months, Campion was 3 times tortured and 4 times brought out for public disputation with Anglican divines. Finally, he was brought to trial with 7 other priests on the 20th of November, 1581. He was so weak from the racking that someone had to lift his hand for him to plead not guilty to treason. But nevertheless, he acted as chief spokesman for the accused and made an able defence. When the jury brought the inevitable verdict of guilty, Campion spoke triumphantly.
It was not our death that ever we feared. But we knew that we were not lords of our own lives, and therefore, for want of answer, would not be guilty of our deaths. The only thing that we have now to say is that if our religion do make us traitors, we are worthy to be condemned. But otherwise, are and have been as good subjects as ever the Queen had. In condemning us, you condemn all your own ancestors, all the ancient priests, bishops, and kings. All that was once the glory of England, the island of saints, and the most devoted child of the See of Peter. For what have we taught, however you may qualify it with the odious name of treason, that they did not uniformly teach? To be condemned with these lights, not of England only, but of the world, by their degenerate descendants, is both gladness and glory to us. God lives. Posterity will live. Their judgment is not so liable to corruption as that of those who are now going to sentence us to death.
You must go to the place from whence you came, there to remain until ye shall be drawn through the open city of London upon hurdles to the place of execution, and there be hanged and let down alive, and your privy parts cut off, and your entrails taken out and burnt in your sight. Then your heads to be cut off, and your bodies divided into four parts to be disposed of at Her Majesty's pleasure. And God have mercy on your souls.
You were listening there to a programme written and presented by Gilbert Villacqua and produced by Sean Patrick Lovett. Our thanks go to both of them. Meanwhile, moving on in the broadcast, I'd like to pick up on a series by the title of Terribly English. That's why they came to Rome. Well, the terribly English person we'll be speaking about in a moment came to Rome in 1860. She's George Eliot, and if you wish to hear more about her, listen on and join me with historian Stella Fletcher as we stand on one of Rome's seven hills, looking out onto the distant dome of St. Peter's Basilica.
Well, we're standing up here on the Pincio, and I've chosen this as a suitable place to talk about George Eliot. Not because I knew that she came here. I have no idea whether she came here or not. I just fancy that she ought to have done. Rather like we know Keats came walking up here a few decades earlier. But I've chosen this spot because from here, looking out straight ahead of me, I can see the Vatican, including the museums and the part of the museums where the sculptures are housed. And that reminds any fan of the George Eliot novels that that was where Dorothea was seen weeping by Will Ladislaw. She's been neglected by her husband, Casaubon. They're supposed to be on honeymoon, but Casaubon spends all day, every day in the Vatican Library, which seems reasonable enough to me, but then I'm not here on honeymoon. Now, we've got the Vatican in that direction. Over on my left, we have, a few hundred yards away over there, Via Sistina. That was where the characters in Middlemarch, Dorothea and Casaubon, were staying. And I just thought this was a nice spot between the two to appreciate that literary dimension. Because the wealth of 19th century English literature is such that the Italian cities, Rome, Florence and so on and so forth, feature so strongly. And I thought that was worth talking about in this series. George Eliot came to Rome herself in 1860 and was distinctly unimpressed. It was Holy Week, Rome was full to bursting with pilgrims, with visitors. and the weather was absolutely foul. The Romans referred to rainy weather as English weather. But when English people such as George Eliot and also Newman came here, they were appalled by the intensity of the rain, which effectively confined them to their apartments. Over the course of her visit, George Eliot got to know the city a little better when the rain held off, and appreciated it more and more the longer she stayed. However, she was pretty sceptical about some of the Holy Week ceremonies that she saw in St. Peter's. Again, you can see St. Peter's quite clearly up here on the Pincho. George Eliot's interest in Italy comes through in a number of her novels. We've mentioned Middlemarch, that's got the Roman dimension. Romola is set in 15th century Florence. Daniel Deronda is set in Genoa, and also the short stories, Scenes of Clerical Life, have a strong Italian dimension. Italy was very much to the fore in the thought of 19th century British liberal types such as George Eliot. Why? Because of the push for Italian self-determination, nationalism, if you like. Italy in the first half of the 19th century was divided between a number of foreign powers, particularly the Austrians, who dominated the north of the peninsula. There were plenty of Italian exiles in Britain who objected to this foreign domination and who wanted to have Italian self-rule, an Italian nation. This was the push towards the Risorgimento. Mazzini was an exile in England, and George Eliot was particularly familiar with his thought. So when she came to Italy, she was conscious of this great surge of Italian nationalism. So we were talking 1860, remember. Also, she and many other thinkers and writers of the day were very keen on Italian literature, Dante in particular. Now, Dante was one of the heroes of these Italian nationalists, so it's all fitting together. Yes, George Eliot here for us is representing the tip of the iceberg of Italomania in early 19th century Britain. After 1815, it was possible to travel once more. You know, the Napoleonic Wars are over, and the British were surging towards Italy. Well, certain types of British were, at any rate. At the same time, there were ever so many Italian intellectuals, if you like, surging towards Britain. Ugo Foscolo, Gabriele Rossetti, Antonio Panizzi. Panizzi was the founder of the British Library, so we owe him a great debt indeed. But very few of the British in Italy in the 19th century actually got to know the Italians. I think Byron is probably the only one. When George Eliot and her partner, to use the terminology of today, came to Rome in 1860, they didn't mix with the Italians at all.
And warm thanks there to historian Stella Fletcher for taking the time to speak to us about George Eliot. Finally, why not join our popular Latin lover, Carmelite Father Reginald Foster, for a brief taste of London town. Laura, you don't know, but I just spent the weekend in London. That has a Latin name to it, doesn't it?
Londinum.
Londinum, because the Romans actually Julius, got there.
Yeah, Julius Caesar's time. The name Londinium, or Londinium, it's the same. And so all those English towns had Roman names there. Claudius was over there and everyone else, so that's thousands of years old.
Well, in those days they arrived perhaps on horses or chariots, but now you travel a bit differently there.
Of course, they came across the straits there.
How would you say the channel?
Freightum is F-R-E-T-U-M, Freightum.
Freightum means channel, exactly.
Yeah, it's like the narrows.
So they crossed and went over. Yeah,
Freightum, Africum or Hispanicum, you know, Gibraltar and stuff, to Freightum.
So we went on the double-decker buses. This didn't exist in Roman times, let alone double-decker
buses.
But
they had public transportation and stuff, and ambulances and carts, you know. And things like that, they did.
What were the ambulances like?
Archera, they called it archera. We have a Latin word in the dictionary. Archera was a wagon to carry sick people around and so forth and so on.
Another thing that one does in London is go to the theatre. That's not a Latin word, is it?
That's Greek,
theater. That's Greek, right.
That's the theatre,
but
yeah.
I went to see a musical. That's a word of Latin derivation.
Well, that's actually, it's much older. It's Greek, it might be even Sanskrit, musica.
Mm.
Yeah, the muses, you know, what came from the muses.
So dancing and singing. Dancing is not a Latin word, but ballet is, isn't it?
Ballo, balla. Well, again, it would be medieval Latin. It's not ancient Latin, but ballet is from ballare, which is, of course, in Italian and all the other languages. But in ancient Latin, it doesn't exist. We have saltare, to jump around.
So we saw this stage. The Latins had stages, didn't they?
Well, certainly. Scena, or the scena, the scene, what they called the scene, was the scena. And that's why they even have the English word obscene. A lot of people think it's something that was off stage, that you couldn't put on the stage, was obscenum, you know.
Anyway, my show was a super show. That's super, isn't it? A Latin
word. That's super, the above, high above is super.
In the Vatican, you talk about supernumeraries. You used to talk about supernumeraries.
Yeah, supernumeraries.
Meaning?
People who are over the number of the apostolic, what do you call these? Protonotari apostolici. Like there are 20, but then there are about 50 others who are over the number. That's the supernumeraries.
So the Latins may not have had ballet, but they had their own celebrations.
Oh, they had the mimi, the mimuses, you know, the farces, and the coturnus, they had tragedies.
What are coturnus?
Coturnus was a boot that they used to wear on tragic, in the tragic plays. And socus was like a sock, you have in English. Socus was a boot that they used to wear in comedies. And so you'd put on different kinds of shoes or boots to show whether it was a comedy or a tragedy. Oh, heaven's sakes, they had all that stuff.
And heartfelt thanks there, as always, to our popular Latin lover, Carmelite Father Reginald Foster, who spent most of his life as the Pope's own Latinist. And that brings us up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks so much for listening. And don't forget, should you wish to check out our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. Bye for now. You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio, Laudetur Jesus Christus.